Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets, and digital money, and ultimately helps you to understand how both digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and today I'm joined by Ulrich Binzeil from the European Central Bank. Ulrich has been with the ECB for more than two decades already, initially started as a senior economist and made, I think, a pretty impressive career at the ECB. For example, previously was Ulrich head of division in the areas of risk management, also director general for market operations. And currently Ulrich serves as the director general for market infrastructure and payments at the ECB and is, amongst other, also very involved in the digital euro project, I would guess. And Ulrich also contributed various papers on CBDCs, for example, on the implications on the financial sector and the balance sheet, but also on Bitcoin, very often together with Jürgen Schaaf, who we already had already in this podcast. So I remember, Ulrich, that we first met, I think, at a conference on CBDC from Monetative. I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. And I'm very, very excited to now have the pleasure and opportunity to chat with you on the topics of CBDC and stablecoin. So welcome to BFRR.
Yeah, thanks, Jonas. It took a while before we managed to have this, but I'm happy we have it today.
Yeah, I'm really happy about that. And because I think it comes to a very interesting time, also our discussion. So today we will cover a few things. Of course, we will discuss about the digital euro, a topic that we also in various episodes took a look over the past 4 or 5 years, and also around stablecoins. So we will, for example, address some questions. For example, if the ECB should give stablecoin issuers access to its balance sheets, or also the future of permissionless DLTs and some lessons learned on the digital euro project. So really both stablecoins and CBDC today. So let's directly get started and not lose time. So Ulrich, you've been, with the bank for a while. I think you made a pretty impressive career. And now I'm Director General for Market Infrastructure and Payments. How do, let's say, digital money-related topics such as stablecoins, digital euro, maybe also crypto assets, shape kind of your daily work in your role?
My department, the biggest, single thing we are running are target services. No, the wholesale infrastructure, RTGS system, T2, T2S, and the TIPS. As of next week, ECMS also. So that's really the big chunk of the work. And you could say that's all about electronic wholesale payments, including the collateral side. But what the topics you mentioned, digital euro became a very big one when I joined DG MIP 6 years ago. It was just starting now. It's a project. It's a directorate on its own within the DG, it has more than 100 people, so that's a big thing. And then the other, let's say, digital topics, digital in the narrow sense, so something to do with DLT or blockchain, so far was less. It was more that from a policy perspective we were thinking through this. ECB is involved when it comes to providing comments in consultations by the co-legislator on MiCA, for example. So we have views on all that, and we develop them also in this department. So that was always the topic, and now we upgrade this further because we look for DLT in wholesale, so what is called sometimes wholesale CBDC. We don't like that expression. We call it a settlement in central bank money, wholesale central bank money in the context of DLT, because in fact we want to start with an interoperability solution for DLT platforms. But maybe if I have to give you a number, digital euro, it's mainly done by the directorate. So maybe I spent 10% of my time only on digital euro, and on all the digital asset topics, maybe another 10%. 60% I spend on target services, yep. I think, and then on the other policy topics, the rest.
Yeah, which is your kind of core focus with, as you said, TIPS, target to securities, etc. So I think, if you ask me, that's all the interesting topics that, are actually on your desk, which I think is very interesting. And you said that the digital euro topic, basically, so the project team also led by Evelyn Whitlocks, that's also part of your unit, if you will?
Indeed, but it's... normally you have DGs in the ECB, you have directorate generals and directorates. And typically, they are both independent areas. Now, in our case, it's special because the Directorate Digital Euro is within the DG for market infrastructure and payments, at least at the moment, that's the organization.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, you've said this, Ulrich, that when you, you know, looked into the topic of CBDC a few years back, obviously it was just very small. And since then, you know, you onboarded like a whole team, as you said, no more than 100 people there. You have been working on the digital euro now, I think, for 4 years, at least like officially with the investigation phase. I'm starting, I'm sure, you know, this has been way, way longer. If you, you know, kind of can draw some, let's say, interim conclusion on what your key learnings were, you know, because it's still ongoing. We still don't know if the digital euro will come. The decision is you know, pending. The legislation is pending. But if you look maybe from today, you know, back to the past 4 years, what would be some key takeaways or key lessons learned from the project for you so far?
Mm-hmm. I mean, first, let me say that I think the project team is doing very well, yeah? So their productivity, their focus on what needs to be done is quite impressive. I'm very happy with the work they have been doing. But still, of course, we have a lot of learnings. And for a central bank, I mean, that doesn't come as a surprise, but going into the details of retail payments and the front end of retail payments is something quite new. So even though we want to rely on service providers, you know, we don't want to have the client relationship ourselves. We don't want to have 1,000 programmers doing fraud prevention and I don't know what. Yeah. So all this the industry will do. We will, you know, put that together, outsource this. But still, you know, we have to take ownership content-wise. We have to understand this. And it's quite a complex new world for central banks. I mean, we have looked at this world as what we call catalyst in our catalyst and policy functions, and also from the oversight perspective, but not as an operator. That's a different level of responsibility. So there, I would say, a lot of learning also on the complexity of retail payments. But I would say we are confident that we haven't overlooked, I believe, anything. Of course, now we wait for the legislation to progress. That is essential. I mean, if we would have the final legislation, that's, of course, even better to continue working, because then a decision can be taken. Yes, we do the digital euro. And once this decision is taken, then also, you know, the industry can go full energy into implementation. We cannot ask the industry to spend, you know, a lot of money if the decision is not really taken.
Yeah, and when we look into the project, Ulrich, I mean, what I could at least from the outside imagine is, and I'm an economist as you, so typically, you know, the personnel was very centered on economists within most or a lot of you know, areas within a central bank, and now this also, at least from my perspective from the outside, had to change more, right? Because now you're developing a product, right? An end user product with all the complexities, with front ends, you know? And again, that's not just the ECB, right? And you're outsourcing a lot, as you said, but this requires also different personnel, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, we are not, of course, you know, we're not only economists here. I always make this point, ECB internally. The ECB is a bank, you know, it's a bank, it's not a monetary research institute. So there are banking operations, there's a balance sheet, we have portfolios, that was my previous job in market operations, and we also issue banknotes, and we have payment systems and all that. So I think you make a good point that in the perception of central banks outside and even inside, you know, that side of monetary analysis and taking this interest rate decision every few weeks, that gets a lot of attention. But, you know, we are doing large scale operations and IT projects, and also wholesale payment is not trivial. You know, the number of challenges we have on the collateral side, the ECMS, T2S, with collateral, it's much more complicated than payment. So the good news is digital euro is payments only. It's not, there's no collateral lag.
Yeah. Okay, that's a fair point, because often you're right, like the main decisions around monetary policy. That's, in the media. Also, when I read articles, it's typically papers that are often written by economists, right? So that's, I guess, why the perception is around that. But of course, you're correct. It's more like, yeah, it's actually like a bank then. If we now look, so after looking back a little, look ahead. So if we maybe say, let's look 10 years ahead. So we are living into 2035. How do you imagine that the payment landscape will look like, right? So how do you think people will pay day to day? And also, what role do you think the digital euro would play in this future?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, people, I'm pretty sure everybody will pay with the mobile phone or the convenience of
one click. Today I'm paying with cash. I want to pay with cash.
Yeah, I mean, if you will be the last one, and maybe the legal tender status of cash may have been strengthened, but what I have seen from the commission, it's not such a strong strengthening, I must say, of the legal tender status. So let's see. But my intuition is that cash will be used less. I mean, the easiest is take the current trend. We have those studies every second year looking at the share of different payment instruments. And I think if you extrapolate that, then in 10 years, cash is not much. It's really little is left, and mobile payments, once you get used to it, it's so obvious, and then you have the habits of the people, past dependency, network effects. So I see a lot there, but what I think is important, and I hope we will achieve that, is that we will not all pay just with Apple Pay, let's say, because we don't want, of course, to have some big tech companies to have enormous market power. So we want to maintain some contestability of markets. We want European players to be in the market as well. We want competition. And the market for, retail payment is an enormous market, and it's growing because what is previously paid with cash is paid by electronic payments. And anyway, we pay more and more now because it gets so convenient. So we make a lot of small payments all day long. So it's a huge market, and I think it's no problem to have the coexistence of digital euro, of private solutions based on instant payments like EPI, and of course also still the international card schemes. I think all those can coexist, but definitely we have to reverse the trend of the last years. And this trend was a never growing market share of the international card schemes. And PayPal and Apple Pay. So that we have to stop, and we should not worry. That's what I'm always saying. We should not worry about overcrowding European retail payments with European solutions. So there's more than enough space for EPI and others, private solutions and digital euro. So I hope that in 10 years we have a healthy coexistence, a more diversified coexistence of various payment solutions with a regained, let's say, healthy market share of European solutions.
Yeah. And I mean, this competition, I mean, that's exactly what I think, what it should be, like the, solutions that fit best a specific use case and, fit maybe a, habit best, then the people should use it. I mean, I'm always saying that because I really pay with cash whenever I can. So I'm always using Central Bank money whenever I can, but primarily for the reason of privacy, like not because I have to hide something, but that I just think, this is some kind of a civil right I'm having. And so for me, at least personally, I hope that cash will still be around for a few decades, but of course you're right. It's the
we are in favor of cash. I mean, of course, we as the Central Bank, we would be crazy if we would not be in favor of cash, because cash is our exclusive product. It has been the foundation of our profitability for decades. You issue something that only you can issue at 0%. People are happy to hold it. That's fantastic. So don't get me wrong. Of course, we are absolutely in favor of cash. We have a cash strategy where we want to preserve the usability of cash. But still, extrapolating the trends gives a clear direction, unfortunately.
Yeah, you see the trends. And I think it's really hard to say, if this is in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years when people really just use their phones. But I think this tendency is clear. And that's also why, at least just speaking for me personally, I really appreciate that the digital euro is going into a direction that where the privacy features of cash are kind of mimicked also for the offline part. Because again, that's something, at least for me personally, that I like to have. I mean, when we look into this coexistence a little bit further, Ulrich, like, what's your feeling on, you know, how big the role of the digital euro could be? Or put differently, you know, do you have a feel for the market share that a digital euro would have in 10 years from today?
Yeah. ECB officially doesn't want to give such a, you know, estimated expected planned market share.
But we are just talking between us today.
So. Yeah, just between us. I mean, between us for sure. I think what is wrong would be to say, digital euro just needs to be a fallback solution. If it exists, it already creates competitive pressure. If it exists, it already increases resilience. I think that's completely wrong, because a payment instrument that is never used is not usable if you need it, because nobody of us has been using then the app for a while. The merchants don't have things ready. So there must be a significant market share of digital euro. But this number, and again, you know, we don't give a number, but this number doesn't need to be 50%. You know, I think it can be also lower. So if it's 25%, I think that would already be healthy enough, you know, to preserve, usability. But with, you know, payment instruments who bring big network effects, of course, it's difficult to predict, no? If it's a great success, it can be a big market share. Or, you know, if we would have difficulties to get this being used to a significant extent, then I would assume that we will think about how to do it, no? So you enter this market with some, you know, expectations and with a marketing campaign at the beginning. You have to do that for sure. And then you have some arguments, you know, why people should use it. And if I can, you know, summarize how I understand this, why should people use digital euro? Some people ask you this question, no? And I think the answer is, it needs to be as convenient as private solutions. So must be able to use it on your mobile phone quasi with one click. But then we benefit on top from legal tender status, from mandatory acceptance and mandatory distribution. So mandatory acceptance, every merchant accepting electronic means of payment must accept digital euro. And if on top we manage, thanks to our scale and hopefully our efficiency, we manage to have a low merchant fee, then the merchants will moreover, you know, push digital euro to the client. And for the client, I mean, for the consumer, the fact that you can pay everywhere with digital euro because it's mandatory in acceptance, that also is an attractive proposition, which others don't have. Yeah. So there, as a public provider of public money, we are supported by this legal tender status. And that, I think that will make quite a difference for achieving network effects. And then let's see, yeah. I mean, even if, you know, I start from the assumption we will be as efficient as others. So that is nice, yeah. But of course, in a market where people have got used to one, you know, they need a reason to switch to the other. So let's see how that works out. But I would say, again, it's a growing market. It's a huge market. And we may have to make merchants happy with a moderate and, reliable fees also. So the private companies by nature, and that's fine, they try to maximize their profits. And if they have market power, why would they not, you know, abuse it, if I may use this word? And we as public player, I believe we can offer to merchants transparency and reliability. And if we have network effects and market power, we will not abuse it. We will be happy because we will recover costs and have delivered, you know, something useful, but we will not increase prices.
No. And I mean, the merchants will be pretty happy about that. If you have lower fees, and I think currently this is clear, the path. And I think that's what we will see, because there will be no scheme fee, which typically is very expensive for most of the international schemes. So I think that's a very big advantage. What I'm always wondering in this direction is, we also talked about that it's in the end about network size and about habits. So network size, of course, this is clear, right? So if this is legal tender, it's mandated, the network size is basically, let's say, given from day one or from day two. But what I'm wondering is really kind of this habit, the perspective of habit, because again, I'm today paying with cash. So I'm just, you know, so just telling things that I hear when people pay, or when I see people paying with Apple Pay or others. But how will it, or where can maybe the digital euro differentiate, or put differently? Today, it's very easy to use Apple Pay, you know, just one click, super easy. And I understand that that's an American solution. I think today, most people, unfortunately, don't care if it's a foreign solution or not. But how can the digital euro compete against this kind of very user-centric, you know, international solution, let's say?
Yeah, as mentioned, we have to achieve a similar degree of convenience. And then we have to make people switch somehow, or use both. No, so again, I mean, I think the merchants, they like digital euro. The merchant associations are really, how to say, our friends. The merchants and the consumers are our friends, while the payment industry and the banks are not necessarily so much the friends of digital euro, for understandable reasons. I mean, they wouldn't mind if public money exits the market and they are left on their own, because that makes more volume for them, more market power, more profits. But citizens and merchants, they like us. But we have to deliver, of course. We have to demonstrate that that a public sector institution can, by relying on the industry, put together a package which is cost efficient, and again, as good in principle as a private solution.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about that typically in your daily work, there's a lot about payments, wholesale payments also that you do today. So about payment infrastructure, you build it basically, also, you know, reflected in your title. What I'm always wondering, and that's like also an aspect that is sometimes brought in by Peter Bofinger on the digital euro, is the digital euro currently is basically, or the future digital euro will be a payment infrastructure and a means of payment. And here, of course, some argue, as I said, for example, Peter Bofinger, that it's maybe sufficient to build in payment infrastructure, like in Brazil, PIX, so an instant payment infrastructure, and not issue a new form of money, which is complex from a regulatory perspective, from all the stuff that's happening in the background. What do you think about such an approach? So basically disentangling this payment infrastructure from the payment object.
Yeah. Peter Bofinger, indeed, he believes both that digital euro will not be used and that it's bad for financial stability. And he wrote this study for the Austrian banks, you know, confirming all this, that it's not needed and bad. But I think the friendship then between him and the banks will stop when he says, let's go for PIX or UPI style, because those payment schemes have been designed by the central bank and are in a certain way controlled by the public sector side. And they are very brutal towards the industry in terms of fees, no? So if you take UPI in India, as I understood, there's no merchant fee, there's no compensation for banks. So, and that's what banks worry about, no? So it's not that if we say tomorrow, yeah, okay, let's draft digital euro, now we do what the Indians do, that banks will be happy. They will be, it's much worse for the banks, because in digital euro, I think we took a very balanced approach, where we say there's a merchant fee, banks should be compensated for their costs. For banks, it allows to keep their client relation. We are more reliable even to the banks than the big techs know. So if you are a bank and you then subscribe to Apple Pay and offer that to your clients, I think Apple Pay takes quite a share of your interchange fee, no? Maybe half of the interchange fee is gone. I don't know the numbers, but so all this, you know, I would say the banks should not be so negative. And I mean, if they look at UPI or PIX, then they would be worse off for sure, because those are really strongly designed from the public interest perspective. not worrying much about the profitability of banks and non-bank payment service providers.
But couldn't you maybe also mix this as a third option? So to say, this would be in payment infrastructure, a retail payment infrastructure that you as the ECB develop, but you decide this, you know, with not having a clear financial goal, but still being about getting the fees down, getting sovereign, you know, so increasing strategic autonomy. So wouldn't that be a way? Because then you wouldn't have this massive fees, right, that you just mentioned that typically such instant payment systems would have.
So you mean we would regulate fast payment based solution, or we would regulate them?
What I meant is not having a solution that is implemented by banks, like that you mentioned, because they often charge, you know, very high fees, but that you say as the ECB, you develop this retail payment infrastructure where you basically also set the fees, right? So then
it completely independently. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was the choice. Digital euro could have been done more as a standalone solution, no? And sorry to say it, but I think we were again... very constructive towards the banks by saying, no, we want to integrate it into the existing ecosystem and banks will play an important role. The alternative would have been a standalone app, you know, standalone merchant devices, QR code based, and then money is uploaded on digital euro through a direct debit from the bank, like PayPal does. Bank has nothing to say. Bank has no income from it. The client relation is gone. So all that would have been also possible. And okay, we said for reasons of also innovation and openness, we instead go for this integrated approach where we have a rule book, and the rule book in a certain way squares the circle between achieving the policy objectives like pan-European reach, low merchant fee, homogeneous appearance across the euro area for customers, while at the same time leaving this open, innovative ecosystem, which, you know, allows service providers to build products around digital euro. So those two things, the rule book should combine. And if it works, it has, of course, also a lot of advantages compared to the closed loop approach to a digital currency, a central bank digital currency.
Mm-hmm. If we now maybe wrap up the digital euro section just quickly, and I mean the next, basically the current preparation phase goes until I think it's October, right? So this autumn. What's next? So how can this next project phase look like? And also, do you have a feeling when we would expect the legislation for the digital euro? I mean, we're all waiting for it, right, for quite a while.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, what is exactly realistic, but that the legislation is final this year is not possible any longer, I believe, because with the parliament took it very diligently to formulate it positively and took quite some time, and there will be a report in the summer, in the second half of the year. So then, you know, the process, the co-legislation process continues. So next year sometimes, and as mentioned, ideally we would have it on the table already when we enter the next project phase in October. That was initially the idea, but we will not. So the question is, what are the uncertainties in the legislation that we have to take into account when designing, when doing the further design work and experimentation? And of course, you know, we will do what is in the legislation 100% at the end, but we can still take assumptions on where the uncertainties are. And I think there's a lot we can do. We can prepare to progress even if we don't have the final legislation. So we have more work to do. You know, the rule book has to be finalized. The procurement work continues. We can experiment. We can think about a pilot. You know, there's a lot we can do. So work will continue. And of course, if then in the final legislation we get a surprise, you know, that some detail is different, quite different from what we expected, then of course we have to adjust. And there is, we have a trade-off, you know, between waiting and doing nothing and, you know, losing time, or taking a bit of a risk that we have to adjust. And we have to take a good, reasonable choice within this trade-off.
Yeah, I think, Ulrich, that's really good news, what you were just saying, so that the work will definitely continue. Because when I talked to banks in the past, I felt a lot of uncertainty, which I feel also holds them back a little, in a sense of, like, what if the legislation is not coming by October this year? Will the Digital Euro project pause? How can I then justify budget for a project team in front of my management? So all these type of questions. So I guess, again, that is really good news that there will definitely not be a stop in October if the regulation is not coming by then. Because I think, you know, we both agree that this is not realistic anymore, unfortunately. All right, but let's now turn to stablecoins, a topic that I also really look forward to discuss with you. So you recently stated, and just to quote you, that I think it was in a paper or a post that you did, that public blockchain networks indeed have high potential in terms of delayering the financial system, immediacy, continuity, programmability, and efficiency. So how do you see the potential of stablecoins, basically based on permissionless DLTs for payment use cases?
Yeah. Thanks, Jonas, for that question. Stablecoins, in another paper on terminology, I'm saying that stablecoins, in fact, viable stablecoins is e-money. No, if we talk about what is that asset, it's e-money, what we would call in Europe at least e-money. And then the question is, how is it distributed? And then we suddenly call it a stable coin when it's distributed on a DLT. And that, from a terminology perspective, I must say, is already somewhat misleading, because, you know, we call a bond is a bond, regardless of whether it is printed on paper or whether it is in a central ledger. Or if it's on a DLT, you know, it's a bond. So e-money is e-money. The same logic should apply. But of course, those things are always confused, and we should try to not do that.
And so, we will definitely link this paper also, Ulrich, in the show notes, because I think this was also a great contribution, because there's so many people talk about the one thing but mean the other. So there's so many terms like cryptocurrency, stable coins, even wholesale CBDC, synthetic CBDC, right? All of that, which all terms I think are not good, right?
But okay, but to come back then to stable coins, or to e-money on blockchain. So the question is really money on blockchain, no? What is that worth? And that brings us to the question, what are public blockchains or permissioned blockchains worth in relative terms also? And in this paper you refer to, that's a paper jointly with Omid Malikan, who is professor at Columbia University. And now it's a good friend, but he comes from a different corner. He's a real crypto person. And, you know, initially we asked ourselves, can we write a paper together, you know? And that was the outcome. Oh, we even had two papers together at the end. And one was on public blockchains. And it is relatively, positive, if you want, on a public blockchain. Because in the public blockchains, that's at least a radical proposition, which takes up the idea of DeFi, you know, decentralized finance, and the beauty of it is all this stuff, multi-asset capability, smart contracts, 24/7, the openness of the public blockchain, so a radical proposition with potential, and. Therefore, also stable coins, being money, private money, but if well designed, the stable coin, you know, there's nothing flawed in the construct of a stable coin, in my view, if the asset side, of course, the asset side needs to be particularly liquid, because the liability side is particularly liquid. So it is. It's not like a bank, where both sides of the balance sheet are mixed in terms of liquidity, and then you have to bring the two sides also together to be consistent. from the capital and liquidity perspective. So here it's a special vehicle, but per se, nothing speaks against its logic and legitimacy in the same way as e-money is nothing wrong, you know.
Yeah. And just then, an alternative, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's commercial bank money, there's central bank money, and there is e-money contracts, which are the same basically as a narrow bank also, and the same as what we call stablecoin if it's on a blockchain. So public blockchain has potential. What we call stablecoin is money, has potential obviously as a means of payment on the blockchain for smart contracts in the context of this multi-asset capability. So yes, all this is potentially relevant. It raises questions, of course, and the big question for me is the pseudonymity and the use of public blockchains for illicit activities, illicit payments, which is, I would say tolerated to quite some extent, and which raises level playing field issues, because on the side of banks, you know, we have effective, very heavy regulation, which, you know, increases costs of cross-border payments in particular tremendously. So we have to ask ourselves the question, to what extent is the praise of stablecoins as cross-border means of payment not also related to much lighter still regulatory treatment? That's the question we cannot escape from the, let's say, societal perspective, no? And we have to convince ourselves that this level playing field is achieved.
And I think the MiCA regulation definitely, you know, is a step in the right direction, if you will, around regulatory certainty, because there are, I mean, also a lot of strict requirements in there when it comes to capital buffers and all of that. So stuff that we know from the Basel world and the bank world as well. But of course, there are, as with every innovation, I would say it's the same with AI. There are always limitations, right? And the question is, what overweighs the benefits?
Yeah, what you refer now, Jonas, is the kind of vehicle construct, you know, the liquidity structure, the asset liability match, and indeed MiCA at the end takes up rules which are similarly applicable to e-money, and I mean rightly so, MiCA doesn't use the word stablecoins but calls it e-money token, which is the right approach linguistically in my view. And then it regulates liquidity more or less consistently with e-money. I mean, I would have said in retrospect, you know, you wouldn't have needed a separate regulation called MiCA. And MiCA says markets in crypto assets. And what is MiCA about? It's about the service providers and the duties of service providers. And then it's on stablecoins, if you want e-money token and asset reference token. But for e-money tokens, which is the more relevant concept, there are not so many asset reference tokens. E-money tokens, at the end, you know, one should just have referred to the e-money regulation in terms of liquidity requirements. And I think that was discovered in the course of drafting MiCA, that it doesn't make sense to end up with different rules, liquidity rules, because on substance, it's the same construct. Again, you know, a bond stays a bond regardless of whether it's on paper or in a CSD or on a DLT, you know, and here it's the same. And my feeling is that was discovered only in the process of developing MiCA.
Yeah, and then it was kind of too late to say, okay, we are not doing it, or we go into a completely different path.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I do see also like the challenges that you mentioned, right? When it comes to privacy, this is a very important topic because, I mean, it's a transparent database, right? So a blockchain is basically the most transparent database in the world. Basically, that's what it is, which can be good, right, if you want to make things transparent, but which can also be bad if, you know, you have specific like privacy regulations, if you want to preserve privacy, if you want to, even like for business reasons, right, businesses don't want to interact where you see, you know, like your competitors see what you're doing. And that's definitely something that technologically that has to be addressed. Also in the background, of course, a lot of stuff is happening on this side, right?
Good point. The privacy for business usage, you normally like privacy for good reasons. And all that raised the question, should you then have a permissioned blockchains? And then what is the value added of a permissioned blockchain? It's a less radical
exactly.
proposition.
That's also often the question I ask about permissioned blockchains, because I do see a lot of benefits also that you mentioned, like the quote I cited at the beginning, like really the layering the financial system. You know, like I often see this like as Lego pieces, right? So where you can basically put services on top, which I think has really a lot of potential in this regard, and you lose most of that, I think, if you have a permissioned infrastructure. But again, you know, as economists, we know there is no such thing as a free lunch, so it's always going into both direction. And I agree. I mean, that in the end, Mika ended up, or for e-money issuers, let's say, so let's just focusing on EMTs, this is now very close to e-money requirements, which I think generally does make a lot of sense, because as you said, you know, it's kind of the infrastructure that matters. But of course, also the other hand side is, and this is where stablecoin issuers, of course, complain a lot, is that if you want to treat this like e-money, you have to do that. And for example, currently the Basel requirements, right, you have to put a lot of equity to back stuff that is on a permissionless infrastructure, which is also not I think from my perspective, not really this level playing field you need, right? So I do see both sides, right? But mm-hmm. you can argue in this in that direction, I think, from a regulatory perspective.
Yeah. I mean, by admitting or starting more from an approach which separates the nature of the assets from the distribution channel, and in an ideal world, you know, reorder the architecture of regulation according to the old logic that you don't mix the two dimensions, that could be considered in the medium to long term, let's say.
I mean, there will definitely changes come at some point. But also, Ulrich, you said that generally you don't think, you know, there's nothing bad about stable coins, right? So there are benefits, there are drawbacks. And we've seen that some central banks also at least look or explore also issuing money on a permissionless infrastructure. So I think, for example, currently in the CBDC project in Kazakhstan, they want to do such a move. I know that currently the also focus of wholesale CBDC is rather permissioned, and for retail it's basically not blockchain at all, I would say, right? But is there something, you know, are you exploring this as well? Can we maybe get like a digital euro or central bank money, let's see, like that on a permissionless infrastructure in a few years?
That's not planned yet. Okay. One day, I mean, happy to watch others. Now, you know, many people watch the ECB on digital euro, which, as you say, is not blockchain. It's you know, following tested conventional technological approaches in retail payments. So there, people are watching us. But I think on putting CBDC on a public blockchain, we are happy to watch others doing it first. It is not yet being considered.
Maybe that's a value-added service that another party can do, right?
Yeah, I mean, but why not, you know, seeing this world develop also with stable coins? I mean, what we in Europe so far have been against is to allow stable coins to pre-fund in central bank money, or to hold their assets in central bank money, because we had, you know, a number of arguments against that. One is that, I mean, the advantage of that is that you address one of the financial stability concerns of stablecoins, that if a stablecoin is very big and, you know, has relatively liquid assets, fine. So from the perspective of the stablecoin, it's fine. But let's assume there's then a run on the stablecoin and it has to sell big amounts of assets. then even in a liquid asset market like the treasury market, it could have a negative repercussion. And to avoid that, one approach would be to grant access of the stablecoin to the central bank balance sheet, allow it to hold at least a part or everything in central bank reserves. But the central bank so far didn't like that, and the ECB doesn't like that for maybe two reasons. One is it blurs the distinction between central bank money and private money, because you know you have a sort of synthetic CBDC if it's fully pre-funded in central bank money. And second, it leads to fragmentation. All that relative to the scenario that you issue directly a CBDC, you know? You could say, I mean, if you want pseudo CBDC, why don't you issue real CBDC? Because then you don't blur the distinction and you don't have fragmentation issues, no? So that was our conclusion. We do CBDC, and we don't allow for pre-funding of stablecoins. But at the same time, we are not exploring, and that leaves a gap in a certain way, we are not exploring the putting a digital euro on a blockchain for the time being, yeah? So okay. Admittedly, then there is this gap. And I feel, you know, there's a lot of talk on the dangers of U.S. stablecoins for Europe now in terms of monetary sovereignty. And that's true in a certain way. But we should then ask ourselves, why are U.S. stablecoins feared to be so successful? And what about euro stablecoins? Why are euro-denominated stablecoins issued by euro area entities not headquartered in the U.S.? Why are they not more successful? Have we done something wrong maybe in our policies? Is MiCA somehow too restrictive? You know what? Why are we so afraid of the success of U.S.-based U.S. dollar stablecoins? Don't hope that euro stablecoins are also successful. I mean, we should ask ourselves the question and come up with good answers.
And it's always good to reflect. And let's definitely go into euro stablecoins in a second. But maybe just to stay on like the synthetic CBDC, or let's say an e-money token backed by central bank money. This is what it kind of be. I mean, at least I think better term for that. Ulrich, yes, I mean, you mentioned that currently the ECB said yes to digital euro and no to this kind of variant. What I'm wondering is the following. Like you said that in the end, a stablecoin basically is very similar to e-money, just on a different payment rail, right? And it's like a private sector form of money, similar to commercial bank money, at least somehow, right? Not fully, but somehow. And here, couldn't you say from the outside, as these two types of money, like commercial bank money and e-money, are pretty similar, why not having e-money providers, e-money issuers getting access to the central bank? Because you know there are not so many out there yet, right? Again, I think from the outside it looks very similar. So you know what are the key reasons? I think you mentioned fragmentation as well, right? But yeah, I think there is some kind of maybe misunderstanding or maybe not understanding the reasons of the ECB out there. Maybe you can elaborate on these reasons again a little bit more.
I think I mentioned the main reason, the blurring of the distinction and the fragmentation. That's at least you know what we also are public on. I mean, we have we call that the pre-funding policy. You find it somewhere on the website under the pages the market infrastructure and payment DG, and those are the arguments we officially give.
And blurring the lines, do you mean between commercial bank money and e-money, or
no? The let's say our pre-funding policy. You know, it's the pre-funding policy which is consistent across institutional forms. You know, it started with so-called ancillary systems because you can access Target 2 as an ancillary system. You know, we have something like 75. Ancillary systems, which are market infrastructures and payment systems, basically, who then settle in Target 2. Then we have banks, obviously in Target 2. And then we have, as of now, or as of October to be precise, we have non-bank PSPs who will be allowed to access Target 2 under some conditions. And so a typical, you know, what is the form of an issuer of e-money tokens? It can be, you know, it can be a non-bank, it's a non-bank PSP typically it would be. So, you know, we wanted to be consistent across all those forms. So we also don't want a narrow bank in principle, you know. We don't want someone coming with a banking license and doing narrow banking business, be it with issuing a stablecoin or not. And we don't want an ancillary system in the form of a stablecoin. I mean, what we said on ancillary systems is that those who can pre-fund their liabilities must do that in the world of retail payment and SEPA, but must not extend the, or those who have access to the liabilities of this ancillary system must not go beyond the entities who have anyway access to Target 2. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the typical payment system for instant payments, which is fully pre-funded, has as users, as clients, the banks basically, you know, who pre-fund in it to be able to do then 24/7 payments, instant payments. And that we implicitly accept as a fully pre-funded vehicle, such a payment system, because all the members of the payment systems are banks themselves, or in the future, non-bank PSPs who have access to Target 2. But a stablecoin, a retail stablecoin, of course, is a vehicle that grants access to to people who have not access to Target 2, no? And that's where we, you know, the policy, which started from ancillary systems, would say no, and it should be consistently applied to narrow banks and to non-bank PSPs in Target 2.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Now, thanks for elaborating on that, Ulrich. I think that from a central bank perspective, I understand that you also say, you know, this, I mean, this narrow banking construct is, of course, very different from the current system we have in place, right? That you don't want to establish, let's say, a lot of incentives that, you know, a lot of the business could happen in a narrow banking setup.
Yeah. And as you know, the Fed... The Fed New York has been having a, you know, a legal dispute with the narrow bank in the U.S.
Yep.
for many years, so it was rejecting this. Now, of course, with the new Stablecoin Act in the U.S., I understand that access to the central bank is not excluded. I must say I have to update myself again on the details. But yeah, the U.S. legislator has now new views, let's say, and also in Europe, you know, views can evolve. I'm just describing the current policies of the ECB. Who knows what the policy is in 5 years?
Yeah. Exactly, and I mean the world changes as we know every day, right? And I think in UK it's also now different. If I don't have wrong information, right, that you also can get this access to the balance sheet, and maybe this is also something that will change. And I mean, even that you said, Ulrich, now that the ancillary systems and Target 2 access is also extended to non-banks, which can also be, at least my understanding, I think some kind of stablecoin-related entities is also something new that changed, right? So the world is evolving. And when we chat again in a few years, we will see what is the policy by then.
Yeah, luckily it is evolving, even for exactly. Central banks.
All right, but let's now go deeper into Euro stablecoins, Ulrich. I've seen that your colleague at the ECB, so board member Piero Cipollone, has like expressed some concerns about foreign stablecoins entering the euro area. So he warns of, like, to quote, credit risk, fragmentation, and dependency on non-European solutions, with banks potentially losing fees, data, and deposits, quote end. So while he sees the digital euro as a way to limit foreign stablecoins in the EU, I think that's, at least from my perspective, only a part of the picture. Because the digital euro and stablecoins will likely serve overlapping, but also a lot of distinct use cases, I think. And we've seen in our last news episodes, we discussed the massive stablecoin adoption we are witnessing kind of in every episode. So MasterCard, Visa, Stripe, PayPal, just to name a few, are all making stablecoin central to their strategies. I think this adoption is somehow inevitable, at least from my perspective. So the question to me would be, shouldn't the EU, and in this regard also like the ECB, actively support more euro-denominated stablecoins? Because this could encourage PSPs like MasterCard, Visa, PayPal to maybe develop solutions based on euro stablecoins, not just US dollar stablecoins, which could potentially even strengthen the euro's global position, for example, if it's used in developing and emerging economies. And wouldn't such an outcome actually align well with the ECB's, let's say, broader objective on the international role of the euro? So a lot of questions in one question.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Piero Cipollone is right, of course. The scenario that we would heavily use US stablecoins in Europe would undermine our monetary sovereignty. It would mean dollarization, or it would mean, even if they're denominated in euro, it would mean a further reliance on non-European entities, or not headquartered at least in Europe. And we have nothing against open markets for services and the role of American or other global companies. I mean, they have a lot of services to bring. We all use a card, a debit card, a US debit card. We often use Apple Pay or whatever. So great service, but there is a moment of over-dependence, and that I think we already achieved in Europe. And if we extrapolate now on top, that US headquartered stablecoins would be heavily used in Europe, I mean, it just goes in the wrong direction overall. So definitely, it raises all those questions.
And this would undermine a lot of the strategic autonomy thoughts also you want to achieve with the digital euro, right? If you now rely more on non-European-based entities in the stablecoin realm.
I mean, we have, even if you just extrapolate the success of the conventional industry, the growing market share of U.S. card schemes and all this, it's already too much, I would say. And then if on top now stablecoins come and are super successful and are America based, then it's not good for our sovereignty. And sovereignty in a scenario of geopolitical deterioration means unfortunately a certain degree of autonomy, because you assume then that you cannot rely, you cannot trust fully, rely fully on global arrangements, which is of course sad, because relying on global arrangements and competition and network effects is efficient, but in a world which is as it is, it's I think it would be a mistake to not have a certain degree of autonomy. And then your second question, what should we do? I think for me it's obvious. MiCA has in principle, and that comes from the legislator MiCA, has endorsed the idea of e-money tokens. So who are we as the ECB then to say, we don't like them? I think the legislator has given them a role and has regulated them. And therefore, there must be something in it. Of course, they must be regulated. And some remaining issues like the travel rule and so on have to be rigorously implemented. So, and that's not yet the case in my view. But I think we should not question the concept of stable coins. And in our retail payment strategy, everywhere we have the statement that initiatives under European governance are good. So you put those two things together, conclusion should be, for me, European stablecoins are good, and any initiative that is taken should at least morally be supported, no? Mm-hmm. We should not say, for the smallest initiative, oh my God, there will be financial stability risk, and start those debates from scratch. If we have MiCA, and MiCA comes from the legislator, and it gives answers to what the legislator believes is required in terms of liquidity. So that should be it. No, and then we should see. And then when there are those entities then developing and we start to get concerned because they are huge, okay, then let's take it up again, but not now. I mean, then otherwise I would say we are in this in this cliche, bad cliche about Europe, that we are excited, regulate, and are concerned, you know, before anything is happening. Yeah. That cannot be the right approach.
No.
Yeah. And then the other question is, what can we do, you know, beyond moral support? And
yeah, because I was initially, why I also was wanted to ask this question, Rui, is that my feeling is when I read official ECB public statement, again, I could misinterpret them, is that there is rather some skepticism regarding stablecoins, at least, again, in my interpretation. And I'm just try to add one and one, because also every year I read the report that the ECB published on the role of the euro internationally, which I think is really good. And I read in this report always, hey, we want the euro to be used more, right? And this is where I try to connect the dots. So why not supporting euro stablecoins to, in the end, get a broader adoption of the euro in other countries as well? And isn't that in line with the mandate? That's what I was asking.
Yeah. I mean, my personal view is, we should be positive on that. And I think, let me distinguish those two things: retail stablecoins and stablecoins used for wholesale. No, and so for retail, as mentioned, we don't have ambitions that the digital euro goes on public blockchains. So in my view, there should not be, you know, the public blockchain European stablecoin should not be viewed as a competitor to digital euro. I mean, frankly, you mentioned it, Jonas, that the card schemes, PayPal, they all now say, or Stripe, they all hype a bit the role of stablecoins. And I mean, you said they put it in the mid of their strategy. Maybe it is a bit too much to put it this way. No, I know they all now, work on this, and maybe there's a fear to not miss out. And I don't want to downplay it, but there could be an element also of maybe exaggeration of the role, but we have to see. And in wholesale, now turning to wholesale, I mean, the wholesale world is different. There is a principle in the PFMI, the Principle of Financial Market Infrastructures of 2012, which states that for wholesale payments, to the extent possible, there should be the use of central bank money, for good reasons, though, because wholesale is big business of banks, and there the reliance on totally risk-free money makes sense, though, as a standard, and therefore we would be concerned about stablecoin constructs playing a big role in wholesale payments. And that's why we are working now on as ECB, as Eurosystem, on DLT in wholesale payments. Though we have this track 1, track 2, the press release issued, I think, in February, which outlines the work, first the interoperability solution, and then the kind of long-term solution, which is really a bit long-term, but which could be really, you know, it's too early to claim that, but could be a ledger, an integrated ledger where central bank money and assets circulate, a wholesale ledger. And if you think it radically, that if that comes, it could, be the new target services one day. But for that, a lot of things have to happen in our analysis. We have to convince ourselves that this is really the technology. And that's, again, I would say, a lot of studying and experimentation to do before reaching that conclusion.
And what I really liked about this initiative was also the practical approach. So that there was this market, there is this pilot phase, right? Was seen how much interest is there. Firsthand, now there was a lot of interest. So the ECB announced in February, yeah, we will continue. We do this integrated solution, then a long-term solution. So I think it was a good approach to be practical in this regard, definitely.
Yeah.
So we talked about the international role of the euro and the role of stablecoins. That's now maybe as a last aspect in stablecoins. Talk a little bit more on the bond side of things, so on the collateral, on the assets. So what is pretty clear is that the US has recognized US dollar stablecoins as having high potential and that they can even increase demand for US government bonds. So my personal interpretation is that a lot of this push is now coming from in the US from a sense, we need to get our bonds, we want to have low interest rates on bonds, which means we have to have high demand for bonds, which is why we support stablecoins. So maybe a long interpretation, but I think that is one reason. And I mean, for me, the question is just, isn't that an argument for the EU as well? So because, the e-money tokens are backed primarily by, of course, bank deposits and government bonds. But if you have on the other hand side a very high amount of euro stable coins in circulation, you have a lot of government bonds used, which is again good for the interest rates for governments, right? So isn't that a strategy that, looking at the US, that we could look at and also do or at least support?
Of course, if we take now an internationalist perspective, and also take the perspective of the countries where we want then our stablecoins to circulate. Monetary sovereignty is the sum of monetary sovereignties of countries in a cooperative scenario is higher than in a non-cooperative scenario. So if we, regardless of whether we are the US or Europe, if we believe that putting our stable coins on public blockchains to allow big countries, emerging economies who are now subject to capital controls, to then become able, or that people become able to circumvent capital controls and dollarize, that I don't know if it's a very cooperative approach necessarily. So that question we should also ask to ourselves. I mean, if we come to the conclusion that this is not an issue, then I would agree. It would be good to see stable coins, European ones, euro ones backed by euro assets, then circulate globally. It would be a kind of international use of the euro. It would create some sort of signalage income for European entities, which are taxable and generate income then for society as a whole. So all that logic that is applied in the US also applies to us then. And as banknotes, euro banknotes, we have this impressive number of 1.5 trillion euro banknotes circulating in total, and half of it or something a bit less is in the euro case circulating abroad. So you could
wow,
yeah. So you could say if also this type of holdings moves digital on public blockchains, then maybe this international circulation of euro would shrink, and the signalage income earned for the benefit of European taxpayers would also shrink. And then if, let's say, the US has stablecoin issues which are attractive and are substituting then banknotes, then we have lost something, So we should then try to stabilize our share of the cake of this international circulation of currency.
So it's always about, as so often in econ, it's about trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
It's the question of how would it substitute that. But what I also hear from you then is that generally you see the argument for the euro, let's say euro or e-money tokens backed by European assets, that this can can be positive for the government bond side of things, if you will. But what you're also saying is, if I understood you correctly, there are more dimensions to that, right? So also, how would it substitute cash and the kind of cooperation argument that you make, which I guess is right, that the US is probably currently not the most cooperative country, if you will, globally. All right. So Ulrich, that was a really fun discussion. We talked a lot about stablecoins, the digital euro, and maybe just a personal question before we leave. And of course, feel free to respond to it or not. But there has been a news that you will leave the ECB soon. There were also some announcement who will basically follow in your role. So, you know, kind of, do you already know what's next? When will you leave the ECB? Are there any news to share with our trusted circle here?
One news I share with the trust circle is that I will really leave on the 30th of June. So that's on Monday. Mm-hmm. That's my last day after 28 years at the ECB. So I felt, you know, it's time to move on. You know, the greatest employer should not be forever, no? I mean, I think the model outside Germany, like in the US, where people move from, I don't know, public sector, private sector, academia, is more healthy. and with 28 years, I think I'm just beyond the optimal point already. Or I'm clearly, you know, it's time to change now. So, it's not yet clear what I'm doing. So that part of your question, I can't answer. But I remain passionate about payment topics for sure and central bank topics.
I can imagine that this will not be a completely pivot to some very, very different topics. And I've just seen in LinkedIn, like everybody who's then, you know, in between roles says on gardening leave. So maybe you also have some gardening to do.
Yeah, I have no garden, but yeah.
Okay, then no gardening, at least here. And really last question, Ulrich, like when people want to be up to date, like on you and your work, also see what's next, like where can people follow you and your work also in the future?
How to follow that, yeah. I mean, I'm in LinkedIn. I put all my papers in SSRN. Mm-hmm. That's it. I think today in the world of the internet, it's very easy to follow people. And when I have a new main occupation and employer, I will communicate that as well.
Perfect. Then we will definitely link your LinkedIn profile and your SSRN profile with all your papers, contributions. And yeah, so again, thanks so much for this conversation. I really appreciate it. For me, it was very interesting to always ask the question that I had in my head for so long to a person who can respond to this question very well, and to also get some fresh perspectives. And wish you definitely all the best for then the next, your next role, your new role. Looking forward to seeing where this is. And appreciate you coming to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jonas. It was a true pleasure to speak. Thanks.
Great. And thanks, of course, also for the audience for making this episode until the end. I really appreciate it. Of course, if you like this podcast, as always, please subscribe and refer us to your friends, your colleagues, whatever, so that we get more reach to educate more people on the topic of digital money. It is a dynamic time, as we know, and the world of digital money will keep us busy. So thanks for supporting us, and see you at the next episode. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.